that's WPFWFM.org.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and you are tuned into WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is David Engelken. David Engelken is a fiction and poetry writer, a musician and community organizer. He's a founding member of the Humboldt Street Writers Group. How are you doing today, David?
I'm glad to be up early. Thank you.
I'm glad that you did get up early so I can have a show. Okay. You know, we might not be having this morning conversation if it wasn't for the writer Ken Grimes. Ken Grimes died on October 12, 2023 at the age of 74. David, who is Ken Grimes and why is he so important when we talk about the city of Denver, Colorado?
Ken was a force for goodness throughout our city, our metro area, and well beyond. He was a consummate artist, is one way that he's described, and he absolutely wanted a better world for everyone and was... As a colleague of his in a diversion program that he and my wife both worked in, which was how we met initially, she said, you know, I've known two wonderful people in my life, the best people, the kindest and best people I've ever met, and Ken was one of them. Hmm. And besides that, he was a noted playwright, seen as Denver's, for quite a while, in the heart of the Black theater movement here. The key director and playwright for all kinds of things. He would produce plays in a grade school auditorium for Black History Month, and he had one play that went to Broadway and put a lot of work in getting it known nationally and seeking to bring it out into the public on Broadway.
Hmm. You know, when you said the first thing you said reminded me of. You talk about goodness, and immediately I thought of like how people saw John Lewis, you know, and that sort of thing in terms of a person, their personality, their values, their aura sort of affects whoever they come in contact with.
A mix of power and talent and kindness. Hmm.
You know, when you look back on your friend, if you had to describe him for people who didn't know, what are some of the characteristics? You know, like, was he a tall guy, short guy? You know, we talk, this is radio. So, we talk about what impression people were, but we don't have a physical description.
Yeah, it's funny when you ask that, the very first word that popped in my mind was tall. And he was... I guess 6'4", at least 6'5", maybe. He was a track star in high school and went on to run track at Colorado State University as part of his college process, and presence, had a very powerful presence about him.
Hmm. Okay, well, let's talk.
Another thing worth mentioning, one of his theater colleagues I noticed this week had described him as having a smile that very few people in this world get gifted with.
Hmm. Okay. We'll have to mention that to Magic Johnson. Let's talk about the Humboldt Street Writers Group. When was it started and why? You know, I know there's probably people listening and say, oh, you know, I need a group that I would like to join, you know, but, you know, why did, you know, the writers in Denver come together and form this group?
I had written my first novel when I was 12. And
well, you're very smart. You're very, like 12.
It wasn't very long, but it made me feel good. And I did send it off and I got a polite rejection letter, a nice letter.
No, let's go back. Let's go back. You said something.
And
okay.
Then, and
so
then
no. Yeah. Let's go back to your childhood. You're writing a novel. I'm assuming you didn't have many friends. You have time to write a novel.
Yeah, let's not get too deep into that. But anyway, I had all kinds of adventures and needed to get back to writing. And I was walking out the door of East High School. That's our flagship public high school where I'd taught Spanish for a dozen years. And Ken by then was a colleague and a good friend in various endeavors we'd been involved in artistically and a little bit in organizing. And I walked over to the Lighthouse Writers Workshop, which if that's not published or publicized on the East Coast, it needs to be. It's the wonderful network that's serving writers throughout the Rocky Mountain states and beyond, and keeps the connection with the coasts and the cultural action there. So I walked over to their Summer Lit Fest right out the door of my classroom and never looked back, and met four other writers in a workshop with Bill Henderson, a novelist who's done some good work with Western settings in his novels. And we decided to get together after the workshop was finished. And here we are 11, 12 years later. I'm the only original left, but I keep in touch with one or two of the co-founders from back then. And Ken joined us, I guess, probably 2 or 3 years in, somewhere back in the mist. It was a good time for him to start working his plays with a feedback group. And he, of course, became the main mentor for whether our stuff was working right or not.
Talk about, you know, bringing writers together sometimes can be like herding cats, you know. There's different personalities. You know, when you look at a group that's been around for a long time, that says a lot about the people involved. But what was there a certain chemistry in there in terms of why a person would stay in the group?
Right from the beginning, I would say that was true. There was an excitement. We had a young woman fresh out of college who had a novel already drafted. And it was exciting, experimental, with the spirit of somebody who had already departed from this life, mm-hmm. who was suddenly communicating through the new internet. The internet was a lot newer then. And we had our best writer was a Japanese-American playwright from California who we lost to California. She had to move back to help her parents who had a nut-growing farm operation there. But right from the get-go, there was a lot of excitement, and that we had long-term projects. We needed to work for the longer term, and we needed the feedback and encouragement to stay with that and keep doing that. Mm-hmm. And though the group has evolved, we've never herded each other. it's always been a case of attraction, mm-hmm. and a common cause of wanting to create what we need to say from out of our experiences to each other and to the world.
Well, David Engelken, if I was a new member of the Humboldt group, take me inside a session. You know, say I'm the new member. What should I be expected to do? What should I expect the group to help me with?
Well, first we'd ask you, why did you want to join? Why would you want to come here?
Okay, that question is like, why am I in Denver, Colorado? Okay, so I'm in Denver, Colorado, right? So what's the next question?
Welcome, Ethelbert.
Thank you, okay.
So we'd find that out and then try to, we do have good discussions about each other's goals periodically.
So you would ask me, some people would ask me like, okay, why am I here? What am I interested in as a writer? Is that what the first thing that would be?
Well, what do you want to do? What do you want to create? And then, you know, sit back, watch what we do. We each read each other's latest from the last month that we've
Okay,
written.
let me interrupt you there.
Podcast.
Okay,
Sure.
I'm the new member. Okay, I see something posted somewhere about your group. Okay, and we'll get into that, into how I would find out about your group. But I'm wondering, should I come with new work? If I come, do I say I'm a poet? Am I sharing my poems with people like you who are writing novels? And so all of a sudden I'm intimidated and I don't want to share my little poem. I mean, what happens here? Should a person calling your group have new work, or should they be trying to finish something?
All of the above.
I knew you were going to say all of the above. This is not a multiple choice test. Okay.
a lot of what we'd be interested in, we'd be very curious about you and about your process and about your background, because our group is extremely diverse in our life experiences, our geographies and our what we've been through, tough times and triumphs. And so, and then we'd be having fun listening
Okay.
to what you were bringing
So
to
I'm
the table.
assuming that, say, every time, how often does the Humbug group meet?
Typically, once a month. We took a 3 month vacation after our book launch in November because we had put all of our collective energy into it, and we needed a break and needed to catch back up with our regular lives. But
Okay.
usually, once a month.
Okay, so if it's once a month, okay, how long does it last? Is it 2 hours,
2
3 hours?
hours. Yep.
Okay, so
Once in a while, it goes a little bit longer if we're into something passionate that
let's leave the passion out of it for a minute. Okay, let's leave the passion. We'll get to the passion later on. But what I'm saying, okay, so it meets once a month. How much time is it? Like, I'm the new member. Would the 2 hours be all given to me, or I'm sharing it with 15 minutes a person? I mean, how's that time broken down?
Yeah, if you wanted to go first, that would be great. And you share what you your poem, in this case, it sounds like. By the way, poetry is an important part of our writing. Yeah, I'd say all of us have written some poetry at one time or another.
Okay.
And and then we'd always be remembered. Ken's first question would likely be, why would I, as a reader, want to hear that?
Yeah, right. Well, why are we here once a month?
So we very much internalized his very direct method of getting to the point. Could I share a fun story about that I just heard yesterday about him that would illustrate his approach to that? Ken grew up in the projects, the Lincoln La Alma projects in West Denver. And I found out yesterday that when he was in high school, which he was a rebellious student at West High School here, and apparently was very productive and probably with a little bit of attention, at least with his English teacher. And somehow he got a grant, probably working with a teacher, a $500 grant, which would have been a lot back in the early 70s, especially in high school, to produce a play. And he had a great title for it, Ride the Rugged Sea. And he produced it in the big open area of the project section of West Denver there, and recruited. He used the money not for actors, didn't pay anybody for that. He recruited his friends to play the different roles. And then he bought a lot of stuff for the audience, including popcorn, with the money. So he had a major treat for the audience. And as his friend was saying, that number one, he would totally be after the quality of a production, and right from the writing on through the actual, in this case, staging and blocking and setting out the roles and coaching actors. That was number one. And then when you're starting to talk to the audience was king. Everything had to be. So that's your first question coming into the group would
And
be,
see, right, and see, and
why
if
would
it,
this matter to this audience?
right, and see, and if I was the person who gave him that grant, I'm saying, like, why does the money going towards popcorn? But let me ask you something about this group, because you know, I've experienced group situations in which a person shares their work, and somebody in the group immediately what they go to is what the piece might be about. But then there's always somebody in the group that's like, okay, let's deal with the structure. You know, when we look at your group, and you talk about, you know, you're one of the older members, has the discussion within the groups changed over the years?
It's evolved, I think, to be more specific, yes, about any particular piece, what we're looking for. And Tricia, my wife, who worked with Ken, we met a couple days ago with Chibi, who was very close friends with Ken, working in what was New Pride. We could talk a little bit later about that as such a formative place for Ken and for a lot of people, kind of as a prelude and accompaniment to his art. But Chibi remembered he would constantly, as Ken would do, if he knew you were in some way or another involved in the creation of his art. And for Chibi, her role, she explained, was he would run characters by her, read plays, have her read plays with him. And her role was to decide whether this impacted her emotionally, a particular passage or a particular character. And I think that is a key part of the evolution of our group, is getting more and more capable of focusing on how do you get past just the words. And how do you actually get the soul to soul impact of the experience to the reader?
Did you ever have a situation where somebody came to the meeting and said, "I'm not coming back to this group"?
Actually, we did. Actually, it was our founding group. We did have, oh, that's interesting, the way you said structure. When we first started, there were five of us, and there was a gentleman who had also been part of Bill Henderson's novel writing workshop. And he came, and his first question was, "Where's the inciting incident here about your writing?" And he was so doctrinaire about you had to have the inciting incident. Everybody knows the industry requires you have to have the inciting, the tragedy thing has to be happening by page three, or you can't sell this. And he was so into the structure, and I think, I don't know the tone of what was happening. I think he only came to two meetings, and after that, we moved on.
Well, you know, when I think about writers in a particular city coming together, I immediately think of the Watts Writers Workshop that was started after the Watts riots in California in 1965. Was there anything happening in Denver that sort of encouraged the founding of the Humboldt Street Writers Group? Like sometimes, for example, maybe there's a new area that's getting, regentrified, or arts, or there's an arts era that's being created, and all of a sudden people are meeting in a certain place and it gives rise to a workshop.
That's a great question. Denver has a history of gold rushes, and the city ebbs and flows. And when we started, it would have been at the rising tide of the latest gold rush that we're still in, of huge influxes of people. I think our population of the city even itself has increased dramatically, and the metro area is just sprawling. And I should probably use other words for the Colorado Tourist Division, but anyway, I would say there was a lot of expansiveness and a sense that the city could, on the good side, attract more of the cultural complexity and layers of culture in all the art forms. And I think that's happened quite a bit. My youngest daughter is a professional dancer, and all professional artists in Denver, I think, struggle to. Well, everywhere, struggle to find that economic base to make a living at their craft. And so I'd say Denver was, on the upswing, and partly that was attracting the talent that we happened to come into in the, again, Lighthouse Writers Workshop being the key axis for that kind of cross-cultural activity from coastal areas and the larger centers like Chicago and the Denver area. We used to be known as a cow town. I still like that side of our identity here, and there, I think people are more accepting of that as part of a bigger cultural vision. And there's some fear of Denver losing its identity soul because of those changes, just becoming kind of an anonymous.
And when you say this, David Engelken, if we look at some of the work that members of the Hobo Street Group, are they capturing this in their writing, this changing Denver?
Great question. Yes, I think so, partly mainly through the diversity of experiences that are in the writing. For example, the book that we just published called An Anthology from Another Bunch of Writers You Never Heard Of.
And I want you to mention some of the names so that we will know who they are. So
And
that's my next question.
subtitled The Humboldt Street Writers Group in Action, honoring longtime member Ken Grimes. You're definitely seeing in that the different changes happening, primarily though in the city itself, in the urban part of the metro area. We don't have, I'd have to think a little bit if any of the plots. Well, yeah, some of this is some.
Well, mention some of the people who are in this book, so that we will hear who they are. Okay.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm thinking immediately of, if I'm getting a little bit to the side of the center city, Carla Siaki would live just a little bit outside the center, and she's a longtime wonderful musician, member of the Colorado Music Hall of Fame, and a wonderful poet and essayist, creative nonfiction writer. And she would kind of, I think, capture more the experience of a suburban, in a way, oh, she's going to kill me, an urban mother and dedicated artist with a long, long line of wonderful achievements. She has a new album out, a new CD out, and with some winning awards for its video. And is a wonderful writer. So that would, you know, maybe be a little bit more toward the urban side of the house. And then the center city side, where my wife and I and Ken, who actually was certainly here before us, and a group of our neighbors on Humboldt Street were creating a culturally enriched, if you would, life, but at the same time as fighting the battles of a neighborhood that's trying to find its future without losing its soul. We'd been through a lot of things on the block. The famous summer of violence of 1993 was right here at the end of our block, having to work through that, the gangs coming into Denver and the drug trade all at the same time, part of it right on the end of our block. But Ken, I mean, we were all drawn together organically. And the fact of that organic drawing of people together continues with the group. I'm thinking of Susan Kaplan. She's a Renaissance woman who does so much kind of work, and she has a wicked sense of humor that I don't even think she's aware of. She just cracks you up. Her story, for example, the title of it is, let's see, and that very much reflected coming out of COVID in our Denver. Let me make sure I'm giving you the title correctly.
Is that the anxiety, chapter four? Is that the...
Thank you. This, in capital letters,
yeah.
Exclamation point. Anxiety, murder, empathy, and a swaying train.
You know, when I looked at some of the bios of some of the people in this book collection, I noticed some interesting connections. Multi-talented, you know, a number of them, like yourself, are musicians. And then I also saw this sort of healing mystical group that seemed to be there, you know.
Very much so. Yeah, it's powerful that way. And I think Ken and I was talking with one of our group, with Jane, your friend Jane Treat. Well, she's an acquaintance. She doesn't tell me that she's a friend, but she said you all ran in the same crowd in D.C. I know she helped manage and book Sweet Honey in the Rock, for example. It's funny, we keep finding these things out about each other that all of us kind of knocked back when she told us about that whole side of her career. But anyway, yeah, it's fun, the big variety and there's a certain healing quality. And as I was talking with Jane about this, I always felt Ken and I had that underneath, that he was very, I know he invited my wife and I to his mother's funeral, the Black Baptist Church in Aurora, Colorado, which is getting, please, Aurora is nothing like the depictions being given in the movie. In fact, right. It's directly opposite. But anyway, it's a sense of very deep spirituality that's formed, that's been given a lot of formation from childhood. Ken's grandkids, especially in his funeral service memorial, the grandkids just talk about that over and over, the deep sense of God that they got from Ken.
Well, so let me link this to something that you said to me before we went on the air, okay? And,
sure.
And you mentioned your last name, you know, this Engelken. And you said that's like little angel. So do are
That's
you
what it means,
guys
Jeremy.
so you just when the group gets together, I mean, does your wings flutter? I mean, is this what has been holding the group together? You know, you came, not only are you the angel, but you also have the commandments that this group is going to meet once a month.
It's not like that.
I'm just asking.
What's fun is if I get tired of trying to be a director, Susan's gonna be on my case, but she knows that. I call her and ask her if she'd take over and start organizing. And Norma, we all share. It's very much an organic kind of thing that we pass the torch to for one another. So there's no one angel.
Well,
And
you know,
the whole
before,
group has
right.
deep, well, we've been around. We're all virtually, although it sounds like we may have a 30-year-old or in her 30s joining us here, but we're all, 70s and above. And it's a wonderful confluence of
Yeah.
gifts and sharing of things.
Well,
So
you.
if anybody has wings, it's everybody.
Right. Well, you know, people have wings, but they also have egos. And I do know that when you put rice together, and this app sometimes also happens at various universities and departments, where all of a sudden, you know, you David, you're getting published. You know, you got a contract with a New York publishing company, and I've been coming to this group for the last couple of years, and I can't get my work out. And then all of a sudden, there's a little, you know, or what happened because now you are published by Norton's company. When you speak, everybody listens.
That helps a little bit. The fact Ken's had his plays produced in as many places gave him an air of authority. But what was nice was he was very much a sharing rather than competing. And I think all of us do that. And yeah, I don't, that's an interesting question.
Well, you know, that's a thing where, you know, it says a lot about Ken because, you know, the key, you know, to these groups, I think of like Duke Ellington keeping a big band together. There has to be something in your personality that says, okay, you can come into this band or this group and you're not going to lose your voice. If you want to go off and make your own album or whatever, you're free to do that. And we encourage you to do that. But while you're in the group, we're going to say, okay, here's how you can perfect your craft. So if I ask you, Dave, okay, put you on the spot. You're
Can
in
I
this.
interrupt you for a moment?
Sure.
That's the best description I've ever heard of our group dynamic from anyone. Thank you. That's
Okay.
a beautiful description of how we work. Thank you.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, I just want to know is that if when you look at this group, and this is just for you, what have you gotten from the group in terms of your work? And are you a better writer because of the people that were in this whole group?
Oh, much better. And it's. You need kind of, I find I need anyway, an inner circle with whom you can share your process and be daring enough to take that next chance and put stuff out to people. Yeah, the group's very important that way. And also, especially for goal setting. Like, I have a clear idea of my next two big writing projects, one of which I started before my kids started getting big enough that they needed more time than my writing was going to allow. Anyway, yeah.
I also wonder about has there been anybody been in your group that has the impact of, say, Charlie Parker? So after they read, somebody say, "Oh man, I didn't know you could write that fast." You know, did anybody come into your group with a sound that was completely different that said, "Oh, now I know why I have ears. This is something I would never even imagine, but I like it and I might try this out." But it's a completely different sound that somebody comes in your group and all of a sudden it changes you. It's like Charlie Parker playing like Cherokee or something like that. And after that, the world is not
Well, we're a little bit humbler about that, partly because
the
we're in a humbler market.
same. You're in Denver.
Charlie didn't even stay in Kansas City, which
Did he
was a lot.
write?
Which was
Any right.
a lot bigger at that time and a lot thicker culturally than Denver was. But we the voices do. What's fun, I think, is just the voices. I'm thinking of Lou Garber, who's without thinking about it too much, and I don't know that he thought of himself as a serious writer. He was a Toastmaster speech maker, and that was his immediate background, but he has this strong and powerful urge to write, and he makes us laugh all the time. His writing just brings through a sense of very...
Well, David, I want to interrupt you because you make me laugh, and I've been enjoying this conversation, but we're going to take a little break. I'm here this morning. I'm talking to David Engelskin, and he is talking about Ken Grimes, who was a key person in the Denver, Colorado community. The show is On the Margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The station is WPFW 89.3 FM.
On Saturday, March 8th, beginning at midnight for 24 hours, WPFW presents One Heart, One Fight, One Sisterhood, visioning justice, freedom, peace, and security for the women of the world in commemoration of International Women's Day. The programming will center the voices of women and girls protecting their communities and resisting imperialism, racism, xenophobia, and homophobia across the globe. That's One Heart, One Fight, One Sisterhood. Visioning justice, freedom, peace, and security for the women of the world. Saturday, March 8th, beginning at midnight. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Okay, we're back on the margin with my guest, David Engelkin. David, you have a short story in this book, an anthology from another bunch of writers you never heard of, but we heard of you because you're on the air today. Okay, but you have a story called Lakota Corner in this anthology. What is this story about?
It's an interchange between a Native American street woman who is in distress of some sort, not quite clear, and a fireman of some limited background, particularly racially and culturally, but of a lot of talent potential too, as the story reveals, and the interaction of him being called in somewhat derisive fashion to be helping what he would have called up another drunk Indian on the street, and at great expense to public tax money with the whole crew and everything, to finding out that he has a lot to learn from his encounter with her and the aftermath of that in his awareness and how he's experiencing some frustrations in his own life.
When you, and I'm assuming you shared this with the Humboldt Group, when you decided to share this with the Humboldt Group, did you feel you needed certain help with certain things in the, you know, to help you when it came to the group asking for help on certain things? Did you have any problems with the story that you were writing?
I'd say it's even a more organic process than that. As the way our group works, when stories and characters emerge, Ken was very involved. I did 13 revisions of this story before I got, that's where I began to learn what's really involved in writing, namely it's revising. Once you have the kernel and the story fleshing out. And the, I was looking for process and guidance in that process. I'm not necessarily looking for any particular one aspect. I'm with our, it's experiential. We're experiencing the creative process of each of us, of a particular work, a particular structure, if you will, an end product that hopefully gets emotionally and curiosity in the reader.
I was wondering, you know, how long were you in the group before you shared this story with them?
I think I started this story in, it's not so much sharing. To me, it's the next project that you're in.
Okay.
And automatically everybody is going to bring something. And it's not like all of a sudden you have some separate thing that you're bringing. It's just what the latest thing you've been working on. And I think I probably started work on this in 2016 and finished the final version in 2018. And it was a great help from the group because I kept running it by, and also one of my co-founders loved this story as it started emerging, and she's gone off on her own. She has a short story collection she's in the process of publishing now. And so once in a while, I'd even drive down to Colorado Springs to run things by her. including what was going on with these particular characters.
You know, you mentioned something which I think maybe our listeners might be interested in. You talked about how many times you revised this story. Okay. Did you, I'm looking at the auto, I don't drive, but I'll still leave with the auto mechanic connection. Do you take the engine apart? When you talk about revision, what are you doing? Are you going back, adding something to the character? Are you changing the setting? Are you changing, working on the dialogue? What are you revising?
All of the above. And
did you ever just say, I just forget about this story and let me start all over again?
No.
Okay.
But the process tends to be, in our group, what's missing. Mm-hmm. And the poem that I published in the book, I had lived with a long time and I liked it a lot. I kind of had a sense I want to get this published. And the first time I read the whole thing through in the group, Ken Grimes had one question for me. He said, "Is that where it ends?" Mm-hmm.
Well, let's look at that. Let's focus on that.
The result was, in terms of process, I think it's part of what you're asking about. Mm-hmm. At that point, what we learn as a group to do is, oh, I have to live with this for a week or two or even a month.
But what about the other thing about, you know, right? What about the other side of it? Revising, right, but not letting it go.
Oh, you mean you get to, it's funny. I would say that we each reach kind of that famous phrase or term epiphany. Mm-hmm. I think you get to a point in a good group process like this where, oh, that's not going to get any better. Mm-hmm. For example, we were talking about your friend Joy Harjo, who I reached out to about this story because I wanted to make sure I wasn't in some way being very unconscious racial.
Now, let's stop right there. You went outside the group, David. You went outside the group. Who gave you permission? Who gave you permission to go outside the group?
You know, what you described earlier was we encourage each other to get whatever we can accomplished outside the group, always.
A lot to do with what you were saying about people coming to Colorado for the gold, right? So wherever the gold is, we're going out and getting it.
Could be.
Doesn't matter where it comes from or who owns the gold, we're going to get it.
I like the metaphor. Okay. But anyway, yeah, with this one, I reached out to Joy, and I realized after I had taken in her basic quick take on it, she was nice enough to take some time for that. And what I realized after I'd cut 700 words out of it, more or less, okay, my main character still is talking too much, which was Joy's first comment about it. Give the reader a little bit more space from the inner dialogue or outer dialogue of this fireman. But I realized, oh, I'm as far as I can go with this story. I've reached the apex, as Ken would call it, of what I'm going to accomplish with it. And then I just let it go.
What about the challenges of writing, and I guess we all face this, of writing about individuals that are not part of our culture? Like, you know, how do we make sure that it's not a stereotype? You know, or somebody would say, you shouldn't be writing about this community. How do you handle that?
Yeah, my take is, of course, that I try to go to somebody I can find in that community who's willing to give me feedback. For example, I'm friends with Grace Gillette, the head of the Denver March Powwow. And I went to her first and to ask her about this story precisely on the grounds that you're asking. And I discovered as I talked to Grace, Grace does not read short stories. She could care less about short stories. She's a very busy woman who makes this enormous contribution to all the cultures of our city with the event that she has been developing and making happen for decades. And I had needed to find somebody else who would work at that level. So it's interesting how you do have to search for the right person from within the culture you're talking about.
Sure, but then you have these things where, for example, I'm here in Washington, D.C., and I could go out and say, okay, if I was a white person for a show, I would go out and I would say, okay, I'm writing this about a black person, you know, and let me say, well, I'm going to go talk to somebody at Howard University. Well, that person has completely different background than, say, somebody who's in Southeast, who you know, is growing up in the community. And I'm not stereotyping Southeast, but I'm just saying that, you know, when you look at the Black community or any group, it's not monolithic. So if you say, okay, I'm going to go talk to the one Native American I know or the one Black person I know, that doesn't necessarily mean that that person is going to provide you with the insight that you have for your short story character. Because
absolutely.
It might be...
You know, absolutely. Very astute observation. And I'm going to be dealing with one project that I'm working on now is set back in small town, rural Kansas, the kind of community that I'm from. And I've got to get back inside that community or that kind of community to bring that kind of character, which will be very different from other characters in the story who may come from that same background, but who've gone through a much bigger urban or university or other kind of experience.
But you know, when you say that, David, and we look at, say, writers from Africa or the West Indies or even Europe, sometimes somebody leaves a country, they write and stuff like that, and they come back and somebody says, oh, what you're writing about, you know, we don't do that anymore, or we don't sound like that anymore. You know, so also like that you realize that, you know, that you coming back to the old country, and the country now has moved way ahead of where your work is. And after a while, somebody says, okay, what are you trying to do in terms of, you know, honoring our traditions or, you know, our stories? You're tinkering with our stories.
That's interesting. You know, you're bringing to mind immediately Black Punk.
Oh, you know, we talk about
in one act that right. Kenneth, and that he had never published, and it was finished in 1989. And I think he felt it was just too raw, and he was even fearful that it could be treated as obscene, and he left it to us to take the heat for it. After he's gone on and transitioned, although we feel Ken is with us, we feel Ken stays with us. But this could be seen as very dated 1989 punk culture, and it is rough and raw. Ken was working in Philadelphia with an auditing service for the federal government for hazardous waste.
Well, let's look at this, because I got the two books, and I've said, and people know this, when I was just talking about this in a class at UDC last week. You published this book, Black Punk, right? Which it, and on like it's like a companion to the anthology that we've been talking about. And yeah. I said to myself, and I said to these students at UDC, like, who reads plays? You know, unless it's Shakespeare, maybe Arthur Miller, and maybe August Wilson on a good day. But, you know, if you're going to publish, okay, and I'll go back to the anthology, an anthology from another bunch of writers you never heard of, am I going to read a play by somebody I never heard of? You know what I'm saying? I mean, a play. You know, who reads a play? You know, play is usually somebody, okay, I would pick up Black Punk if I'm in a theater group. You know, I'm doing stage, or just somebody, I got an audition coming up and I'd like this little segment or whatever, and I think I'm Denzel Washington on stage. But, you know, what happened? Why did you guys decide to publish a book of play? I know it's sentimental, Ken's not here, you know, but oh, and it's a play. But who's going to read the play?
Well, actually, Ken, he had ALS, and so he was increasingly bedridden. It moved fast enough that he went from being able to walk in my door here on Humboldt Street pretty easily, and then his brothers would help him walk in as the ALS got deeper. And then finally we're meeting bedside with him with computers. We Zoom mm-hmm. from Ken's bedside every meeting. And Ken's mind and his passion and craft are completely intact. And so we work right to the end with him. Ken wanted this play published, and it was in a very crucial part of his own background, partly because it's so different and encompasses a lot more both confusion and ugliness in a way, but not really ugly. He brings the beauty out of that, but it is raw, and it had to be published. Ken was organizing us to do the publishing, and the piece and Ken's being and the group's dynamic and commitment to each other, it had to be published.
Well, I'm glad it is published because, you know, I was joking about the other thing about who reads plays. But on the other sense, as a document, is extremely important because, especially here in DC, where you have a strong punk, you know, historic punk, you know, community, you know, you know, between here along the East Coast, that's very important. So if you look at Martin Luther King Library, it has a punk collection, you know. I mean, this is a type of book where somebody would say, oh, when I think of punk, I'm not necessarily thinking of just white kids. I'm thinking of this black punk. I mean, all of a sudden what happens is that it creates another important document, you know, that I'm glad it's published. Okay. Now I'm like saying, I don't know if I'm going to sign this to my theater group, you know, to do it. But I don't think it's raw considering where we are in terms of language, in terms of some of the spoken word that's out there now, you know. So it's raw, but it sounds like it's raw that has been smoked raw, you know. It's still not that raw, but you know, but it does get into the thing, and this is with the two books, and this is an opportunity to I would like to ask you in terms of, okay, you have these books. How are you getting these books out, you know, in terms, you know, we're doing this show today, you know, and hopefully some people will listen and try to get a copy of this. But how are you promoting, you know, you're keeping someone's memory alive, but what are you doing on a daily basis to keep that memory alive?
Right. Well, of course, we haven't published through Amazon, mm-hmm. and we're exploring how to go beyond that world. And we got wonderful help, Norma Johnson, she's a key, I would say, creative nonfiction and poetry writer who's got this intriguing background of coming from the East, New Jersey. She was a costume specialist for Jay Leno on NBC, and she has all these other talents as a storyteller, and she's in public television, a documentary about reparations. I guess those are called slave reparations mm-hmm. now, slaveholder. Anyway, she does all that kind of work. And she and I have been reaching out to a woman on the West Coast in San Diego who does co-publishing work and who gave us a bid to help us with our publishing of these books. And she got so excited. Her name is Bethany Kelly. Got so excited about the books just by the quality, by the publishing quality that resulted. So she's putting us in touch with Troy Johnson. Maybe you know Troy. He's the mm-hmm. African American Literature Book Club down in Tampa, and so we've got the beginnings of a proposal to him to see if we can get on his website and be part of that. And also, the Independent Book Publishers Association is Bethany's recommending that we work with them, mm-hmm. and of course, our mutual friend John Dingus put you and me in touch, and mm-hmm. and all of a sudden you sent me this unexpected invitation. Thank you. And anyway, so it's like the group works. It's organic. Mm-hmm. It's who knows where this might be better expressed and in a way that won't take us out of our creative dynamic and get too crazy about the commercial outreach.
Let's talk about Ken Grant as we get to the end of our show. Talk about did Ken leave, you know, we made reference to the black funk. Did Ken leave a lot of unfinished manuscripts? And if so, what is happening with his papers and correspondence? Is it a part of like the Denver Library who's assumed any of his archived material?
That's a great question. His son, we work closely with his son, Troy. And there is a fun little moment. I found out yesterday from Troy that he was cast as Tiny Tim. In the first play, one of the first plays that Ken did with his children. And
now we're coming to a disclaimer at the end of our show.
Version of the Christmas story. And Troy is about 6'6", and he's a basketball coach for one of the better high school basketball teams in town, as well as being the guardian of Ken's, along with his brother, of Ken's papers that you're asking about. So I know the file cabinet, and it's mm-hmm. at Ken's house, where I think his son Aaron lives at this point with his family. And that's a great question.
You know, when you have
I
a group,
add that on to Troy and find out how he's thinking down that line. Well, but I think the majority of Ken's stuff has been published.
Well, you know, I say that because, you know, there's a Humboldt Street group, you know, and I'm thinking about things that have happened here in the Washington, D.C. area, you know, where George Washington University, for example, the Gelman Library became a depository for many era writers to deposit their work. And because many times what happens in terms of what you're doing out in Denver, keeping a particular person's memory alive. Well, we can talk about that individual, but if they're a writer, there should be some place that we can go where their papers, or maybe I'm doing a history of the literary community in Denver, and I need to know about how the Humboldt Street group, who the members were. You know, I mean, I looked at the back of this book. There's a wonderful picture of everyone standing around Cannon, who's in bed, and it's a really nice photo. You know, but you know, I'm looking at, okay, I want to use this photo. Who's the photographer? You know, all these other questions that give rise.
Well, in that case, you've got my email there in the book. I'm point person for that kind of thing. But you're also making me aware, we've thought about this just a little bit, that these books probably, and I think they've changed the name of it at the Denver Public Library, but it used to be called the Western History Library or Division of the Denver Public Library. And we do have a fabulous central library, which is kind of world renowned. And so my first thought would be that, yeah, these books, for example, as a couple of books that Tricia and I did a long time ago, are in that, and they do serve the kind of thing you're talking about, the history and the part of the important history of the city and the people that built it. And that's my first thought. You probably want to keep that local.
Do you
That
do that? Right,
suggestion is interesting.
During the course of a year, do you, as the Humboldt Street writer group, do you guys do like a public program once a year?
You know, we're kind of setting a goal of doing once a quarter, doing a little event, and we're very localized. It's Carla and Susan are both involved in a Jewish community over on in Southeast Denver, and which is teamed up with a Christian group for facilities as remodeling needs demand those. And I think our next gathering will be for those two congregations together. And those are the most fun, making those as cross-cultural as possible, the gatherings, and have readings. And the last one we did, we had Afghan food that my wife's work with some refugee families helped to bring together. We had a jazz musician there with his little combo. And it was just a wonderful celebration. So yeah, our goal is to do three or four of those a year, starting very locally with
Okay,
community.
well, two last questions. One's a quick one. You know, this, you know, we're doing a radio, but you know, this is a Zoom session. So I saw your wife. I assume that was your wife in the back there.
He
And I was
came.
wondering, you know, we talking about the group. Is she the first reader? I mean, is the person who, is before you get to the group that you share it with her?
It depends. It
Uh-oh.
has happened. She's also smart enough to keep her own life intact without getting too pulled into all the minutiae that go into this kind of work. So
Okay,
I'd say
tell her I'm going to send her an email for an invitation, and we'll talk about you. But on the let's end with you, David Engelking. One last question: how would you like Ken Grimes to be remembered?
as that goodness that's very socialized. As a goodness that is both personally very whole, very rooted in family and place, neighborhood, but also that reaches to the bigger world, in a way, the cosmos that we all share.
Okay. Well, at least here we know it's the audience of the PFW. So I want to thank you, Ken, David Engelken, for being my guest. David Engelken is a fiction writer, poetry writer, musician, community organizer out in Denver. We're a member of the Humboldt Street Writers Group. The show's on the margin. My name is Jesper Miller. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
Thank you.
on Saturday, March 8th, beginning at midnight for 24 hours, WPFW presents One Heart, One Fight, One Sisterhood, visioning justice, freedom, peace, and security for the women of the world in commemoration of International Women's Day. The programming will center the voices of women and girls protecting their communities and resisting imperialism, racism, xenophobia, and homophobia across the globe. That's One Heart, One Fight, One Sisterhood, visioning justice, freedom, peace, and security for the women of the world. Saturday, March 8th, beginning at midnight. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hello, I'm Dr. E. Faye Williams, National Chair of the National Congress of Black Women. And you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
On Saturday, March 8th, beginning at midnight for 24 hours, WPFW presents One Heart, One Fight, One Sisterhood, visioning justice, freedom, peace, and security for the women of the world in commemoration of International Women's Day. The programming will center the voices of women and girls protecting their communities and resisting imperialism, racism, xenophobia, and homophobia across the globe. That's One Heart, One Fight, One Sisterhood.